and I asked them if they were not also naturalists, perhaps because I remembered the great explorer that Spain recently lost, miserably, because while other television scroungers squander money by the bucketful, he, as the peasants say, was counting chickpeas. The Castilian Felix Rodriguez de la Fuente, and his thesis on the balance of the ecosystem, from which nature must constantly benefit if we want it, in turn, to continue to fully fulfill its function for the benefit of human beings. I have often wondered, likewise, if Professor Rodriguez de la Fuente would not be killed precisely by his well-done work, because awakening and cultivating the sensitivity of people, and especially those of humble condition, in this world, almost completely idiotic, is an unforgivable sin. In any case, they did not forgive Rodriguez de la Fuente. What I no longer had the slightest doubt about was that these beings, I am referring to them, of course, and their companions from other planets, were sober people, for whom food did not seem to be a kind of delight or refined pleasure, to put it, how else, with earthly words. I was soon to find out, since, when the screening was suspended, they asked me if I was hungry. Food in tablets. This time it was my female neighbor who took a small tray from the table, which looked like silver and on which there were about a couple of dozen tablets of various colors, the size of a pea. It is concentrated food, she told me. We use it during our trips. Take two or three of them and you will regain energy. I took two tablets and dissolved them in my mouth, taking a sip of the soda that tasted like orange lemon grapefruit. I would be lying if I said that at that moment I didn't miss a good plate of vegetables, one of those my partner prepares for me, and a grilled steak, washed down with a traditional red wine from the area. At first I thought that those tablets tasted like stew from a La Mancha or Extremadura, even with an aftertaste of chicken broth. I was surprised, as I say, to see that, in a matter of seconds, I felt like I had been well fed. Something amazing, especially considering that I am one of those who cannot eat without bread, a hobby that many of us have from the difficult times when, for the working class, bread was the basic food, with wine of course. It could also be that, in that unusual situation, my appetite was not entirely normal. The fact is that it was that frugal meal that, without a doubt, inspired me to approach other kinds of subjects, let us say more ethereal. So, what effect does lyrical, poetic language have on you? Or is it that it doesn't move you at all? You see, verbal communication is no more important to us than communication through silence or through the gaze or through touch. Beautiful words, beautiful phrases are typical of those who, deep down, are afraid to call things by their name, who like detours and parables. What you call romantic or lyrical poetry, for example, flows spontaneously and naturally in us when we discover some new wonder of the universe or when we hear others recount some experience. Fantastic. We can assure you that in each one of us there is a poet or a musician, because the development and enrichment of our sensitivity is continuous. It never stops. Do you understand? Why do we need a small, select group of poets to come and sing to us the beauties of our particular environment or of the universe, if each and every one of us has enough sensitivity to appreciate them? Or to come and recite dramatic situations that are unknown to us? You must never forget that, in our communities, no one has closed the door to any field of creation. We all have full access to the wonders of nature and the universe. We have already told you this, but it must be repeated, because in the correct understanding of this reality lies the key to understanding the other realities of our life. The most beautiful impression passes, partly erased by another, which arises later. That is why the past is immediately archived, since all our capacity for wonder, for marveling, for achieving an exact appreciation of our discoveries, is focused on the present that is already, at the same time, the future, which necessarily forces us to keep our minds clean and open. Our past is never a burden and even less nostalgia. There was another silence, which this time was brief. It seemed as if they had guessed that, with their long speech, I had been plunged into a disconcerting perplexity. They lived without literary cliques, without praise and distinctions, without lyrical poetic nudges and tricks. The voice continued, "We understand, knowing as we do the limitations that you put on your existence, that all this is not easy for you earthlings to understand, that you repress your emotions and sensations too much, which, without a doubt, limits your sensitivity tremendously, when it does not sterilize it, because you abuse it a lot and subject it to more unfortunate than happy situations." Route followed by the author, from the private road of the Hotel de Tamarius, Prats de Molo, to the meadow where the extraterrestrial spaceship Alius del Cosmos was located, on the edge of the Les Belladres Forest Road, and about 300-400 meters from the French-Spanish border. A few notes on the fine arts. So, the great painters, the great composers, the great sculptors, the great soloists, the great writers. In a word, our great men. The voice, this time, took a while to respond. So, the great painters, the great composers, the great sculptors, the great soloists, the great writers. In a word, our great men. The voice, this time, took a while to respond. Well, we don't want to demoralize you, but for us this unbridled love, so to speak, for old stones, for lifeless, inanimate things, even if they are history, seems a serious contradiction if compared, above all, to the little zeal displayed towards things that breathe life through every pore. The mere fact that you have to call a few individuals great is already a rather humiliating fact. That means that there are many others who are small. Isn't that so? In reality, that is another aspect of the great slowdown in the evolution of the human race on Earth. What is known as fine arts is something that is reserved, in practice, in its enjoyment, to tiny minorities. This gives the exact dimension of the failure. And why fine arts? Are there ugly arts? And why has the artistic range been so restricted? Well, of all the limitations established in your civilization, that is one of the cruelest, because it cuts off the sensitivity and the creative capacity of the vast majority. Do you understand? Of course I understood it. I was not going to understand it. What astonished me and outraged me at the same time was the realization of my own limitations, since I should have measured the full extent of such injustice by myself, without them having to help me at all. The silence that followed prompted me to reflect again. Let's see, why should a painting or a sculpture be given more merit and value, than a piece of furniture, a toy or a basket of fruit or vegetables? If the painter, the thinker or the sculptor did not have a comfortable bed, and the performer or the composer did not have good food to eat, would their muses be so fertile? Besides, you only have to see where the fine arts have ended up, in the hands of a few merchants who dedicate the product, the works, of so many artists, consecrated or not, for the delight, as they say, of the experts. One rather thinks that all this is pure sentimentality. But let's continue. A few hundred privileged families, residing in the most powerful countries, with wealth almost always obtained through bad arts, currently possess much more than half of the art produced over several centuries. There are museums, that's true, but how many inhabitants of the earth know about them? And, taking that as a starting point, what is the point of this artistic revelation of museum visitors? That is, only when artists become recognized by experts, how many admirers of their art have been able to devote themselves to the practice of one of the fine arts? Do artists not realize that their sowing only yields meager harvests? What do these artists do to ensure that visitors truly enjoy visiting the halls of a museum and to facilitate their access to any of these arts? They assume, which is a lot to assume, that the mere sight of so-called works of art will awaken some artistic curiosity in visitors. This is without taking into account when civilized nations have devoted themselves, are devoted, to stealing the artistic treasures of defenseless countries, to take them to their museums or sell them to private collectors. We ask, in the name of what art can such outrages be committed? Therefore, in any artist we take as a sample, from whatever branch, we will see that he is not only in the hands of the merchants on duty, but that these, and their wealthy clientele, condition, mediate, if not adulterate, his work and castrate the creator, who is enslaved by money and fame, basic food for his arrogance, that can give him the price of his art. This pseudo-artistic sensitivity is used as a mask and, at the same time, devalue sensitivity as such, which is something natural to the human race, which should be, and by adding the tag artistic a shameful and humiliating discrimination is established, since this contributes, it is one of the many faces of social and economic inequality, to negatively influencing many people. They are made to feel self-conscious and almost to beg forgiveness from the chosen ones for not having, according to the canons pre-established by experts, artistic sensitivity. Therefore, when someone goes alone towards one of these arts, he is either forced to turn around and escape to his troglodyte cave, thereby doing nothing more than returning to his roots, and keeping a healthy distance from civilization and from what is dictated by the standards imposed by the artists in vogue and their followers, or he has to let himself be swallowed by the enormous octopus of materialism, or die of disgust, of drunkenness, like the great Modigliani, or commit suicide, like the tormented Van Gogh. We could not cite a single case of an artist who died peacefully in bed, after having succeeded in one of these fine arts, who can show, to his credit, a positive contribution to the only possible artistic revolution, that of having stayed away from commercialism and having dedicated his life to creating in the most absolute freedom. Understanding creation as the permanent resurgence of young artists stimulated by it, our brilliant Picasso, let it be clear, must be fed a separately. Visiting the Picasso exhibition at the Grand and Petit Palais in Paris, the then Minister of Culture, André Malraux, answering a question from General de Gaulle, President of the French Republic, about what the Spanish painter had represented in art, said to him, in 2,000 or 3,000 years Picasso will be considered a contemporary. And we will be proud of having discovered him 2,000 or 3,000 years earlier, when he was still alive. I mean that we do not only consider our great painter to be outstanding in the artistic field, but we are referring to his human side, to the acute sense of solidarity and camaraderie that he practiced and cultivated like few others. The Republican exiles of 1939 and the children who lost their parents between 1939 and 1944 in France, had good proof of the inexhaustible concern of Pablo Ruiz Picasso. And we have thought it fair to insist on this because this type of behavior is very unusual in people who have reached, thanks to their art, the highest peaks of fame. We must recognize, naturally, that we have a voluminous artistic capital stored in documents of all kinds, with which they try to demonstrate that the arts have progressed, which is a pure illusion, since, to begin with, immense layers of humans have not even heard of the existence of this fabulous capital of art. What is more, many of them would not even have the strength to stand up and open their eyes wide in a museum or library to admire a painting or an incunabulum, nor the ear to listen to a piece of music, if that possibility were given to them, which of course it is not, at least in the free Western world. So, where is beauty? And where is art? Or what some earthlings want to make those words represent? What can we, the inhabitants of the earth, especially the chosen ones, be proud of in this area? Remembering these realities will surely make certain people open their eyes to a great extent. In particular, those who hang around, vegetate and seem to enjoy these rigmaroles mounted on the fine arts. Pride often secretes inexhaustible doses of self-satisfaction in the form of indignation, sarcasm, indifference and, in some cases, uncontrollable aggression. What's more, it is in this field, that of the fine arts, that, if we aim carefully, we will perhaps see that the deceit of the merchants has reached its highest levels. Not always by the hand of artists, of course, although no one can deny that the vast majority of them let themselves be loved, often without too many scruples, but by those who have judged it prudent, many times, to adorn their misdeeds with ostentatious philanthropic displays. And, at times, they have not even kept up appearances, because they also take off their masks from time to time and make a clean slate, if it is profitable, of that which the day before seemed to venerate or adore, and vice versa, praising today what they abhorred yesterday, especially if, in the meantime, the artist has disappeared from the world of the living. So things being as they are, now it is up to all of us, without exception, but above all the so-called intellectuals and artists, to retrace a large part of the path taken. We must become humble, returning to our human origins, doing our bit in the fight against the heartless people, and against their schemes of all kinds, that condemn us to living without our lives. Let each one of us take stock of our own life and reflect on what we once dreamed, as a child, that we wanted to be and what we have been forced to be. A few notes on the wise. Then we also talked, at length, about research. For example, what can we say about our scientists, our scientific researchers? Consider carefully, the voice told me, what has been achieved with such scarce means in this last century on Earth, and ask yourself what you could have achieved with infinitely more resources. Think, Earthlings, of all the resources that you devote and continue to devote to manufacturing weapons, munitions and destructive devices. And if, as is natural in our communities, every human being on Earth were also a born researcher in something. I reflected, it is clear that all research will always be mediated by practically insurmountable imperatives without a radical change in the direction of our society, which is not possible without a profound remodeling of our way of life. Research is conditioned by the lack of resources, in most cases, and, partly because of this lack of means, there is a serious lack of coordination between the various research bodies. It is the classic division of labor of capitalism. Isolating people, at work and outside of it, is the best seedbed for increasing and maintaining a lack of solidarity. For example, on Spanish television, on the 18th of September 1981, a meteorologist, about 45 years old, appeared who confessed to not having the slightest notion of biology or any relationship with biologists. This was said when he was informed by the interviewer of what a young Spanish biologist had just declared. Let's see if by causing artificial rain, that is, the intensification of precipitation, we will not end up creating a tropical climate where there never was one, and might trigger, with it, not just simple rainfall perhaps, but real climatic catastrophes, such as tropical cyclones. Let us emphasize, in passing, that there is something more serious than this lack of coordination, and it is the lack of plans and programs of concerted action, at all levels, national and international. Because research, if it is not projected as a global and common task, and not as a sniper, although there is some sporadic contact between the different research bodies, is an enterprise whose results will always remain far below its potential. This is as far as the nations are concerned individually. Now calculate the damage that comes from each nation, besides not being internally cohesive, acting on its own account and risk, with hardly any contact or communication with the outside world. That is why the advances of terrestrial science have been so modest, and note that we do not value them by comparison to the levels reached by other extraterrestrial civilizations, but by contrast with the waste of resources in essentially destructive or intrinsically commercial programs. The scientist who, in relation to the state, should be characterized by his rebellion, because that is his fate, dissatisfaction with traditional science and, therefore, with those who, in one way or another, support and protect it, turns out to be a submissive servant, either of the state or of industrial interests, it makes no difference. Today it is not difficult to see that in this field, as in almost all those in which the so-called wise men are involved, the most irresponsible and numbing conformism reigns, and that their consciences, to put it in some way, are as dull as those of any pedestrian in history who is marginalized from historical activity. And this is a hindrance that the world of scientists has dragged along from far away in the mists of time. Because researchers of the human stature of the Curies or of our Santiago Ramón y Cajal, alas, are very few. There has never been the case of a researcher, or a group of them, setting fire to their facilities or laboratories, or deserting them, leaving to cultivate a vegetable garden or raise chickens, proclaiming to the four winds, "We do not do more research because we are only given 0.03% of the budget," while two steps away there are arms factories to which fabulous sums are allocated. And leave every living person without aspirin or sleeping pills. At least for a while. But no, in general, they prefer to continue begging and playing the victim and the misunderstood. The emblem that the crew of the extraterrestrial spaceship Light of the Cosmos wore on their chest, at the level of their heart. Drawing made by the author a few hours after meeting them. The drop of water represents life. The wings of the bird represent freedom. And the central eye is the sun, another vital source. The interior of the eye, multi-prism and multicolored, brilliantly alive and changing, represents the unlimited capacity of perception and observation of the human and animal gaze. The ship was disc-shaped, 50 by 75 meters wide, 10-12 meters high, and of a metallic leaden color. The central disc was perforated with panoramic windows. At the top and bottom of the central disc were two lines of eyes from which the sea of multicolored light emerged. The mechanical ramp, which appeared from the underbelly of the ship, was about 4-5 meters long. The ship was placed on four tubular legs. This was the sad end of the Reverend Father Oribasio, at the hands of the small and peaceful inhabitants of the planet Atama, victims of the terror he instilled in them by explaining the martyrology of the saints of his church. See the chapter Once Upon a Time in the Future. Witches and Priests. And, naturally, the time came to talk about religions, even if we ran the risk of seeming superficial. This was perhaps the only time when the voice hardened somewhat. It is known that, since ancient times, the life and coexistence of men and women were mediated and conditioned by the demands and threats of the witch or sorcerer of the tribe, and by the taboos based on superstition and the fear of being punished by the supreme being. It is the legends practiced by them, later the priests will come, that first generate the taboos and then the dogmas. That is to say, to the anguish of an inevitable death is added, through the work and art of the saviors of souls, the danger of eternal punishment. In a word, the human being is promised an afterlife, full of blessings in exchange for resignation, that is, the renunciation of making his life, in the here and now, a dignified, happy and full existence. I thought, it is true that, with the passage of time, when taboos and religious dogmas could not completely stupefy and frighten people, philosophy was invented, and in the modern era, politics and sociology. The latest discoveries have been bureaucracy and technocracy. In the most advanced countries, the real areas of domination are occupied by psychoanalysts and psychiatrists. These people, and others of equivalent human meanness, have managed, with their laws, traditions and fashions, almost like the sorcerers and priests of old, to make what is immoral be considered moral, what is abnormal normal, what is unjust just, and even what has not the slightest trace of logic logical. Their theories are nothing more than a vulgar jumble of formulas and sentences of a tremendously opaque scientism. One day, perhaps not far off, we may easily entertain ourselves by putting together a manual based on nice words, set phrases and rounded paragraphs, from antiquity to modernity. Because the truth is, and there are consequences of so much inauthenticity, the confusion, the bewilderment and the fear that dominates, that oppresses the vast majority of human beings, that on earth, from Aristotle to our days, we have been getting drunk on words and concepts, which have been the trees that prevented us from seeing the forest, that which, according to the thinkers, should nourish our understanding of the world day by day, forgetting the life projects that they had the moral obligation to propose, and to contribute to the elaboration of, the projects of life. Also on a daily basis, so that these words and concepts would go from being empty terms to representative and enlightening signs, full of life, with a full irradiation and projection, so that the evolution of the world towards well-being and happiness would be the result of this collective understanding and elaboration. That is, to put forward the only words that, in my opinion, are valid, those that unleash the revolutionary action that is the only one that heirs and heals history. As an eloquent point of reference, close as can be, we will remember the case of Germany. Of the culture Germania. Here is a nation made up of extremely religious people, Catholic and Protestant, with a slight preponderance of the latter, filled to the brim with philosophers, thinkers, writers, poets, scientists, composers, illustrious doctors, great festivals and artistic events, renowned orchestras and famous soloists, who not only gave birth to and supported the Nazi regime, but also collaborated in the invasion, subjugation and genocide against other peoples of Europe, leading to something that is the greatest disgrace, in the modern era, for a world that boasts of being civilized, the German extermination camps. We ask, what was the use, then, of 95% of Germans having received a religious education and civic instruction, apparently exemplary? And with the same religious background, let us not speak of the genocide of peculiar Francoist coinage in our parts. It is not necessary to go back to the times of Copernicus, Galileo or the Holy Inquisition. Here is what Professor Pedro Lane Entralgo recently said in Madrid, at the opening of a course on science. The vicissitudes suffered by Spanish botany are countless and continue into this very 20th century. The incipient blossoming of this science, with illustrious names such as Fernandez de Ovejo and Francisco Hernandez, was halted by the publication of the indexes of prohibited books, which included the classics of Renaissance natural science, without which progress was not possible. Thus, Spain was left behind, while in Europe science itself was being established, moving from descriptive knowledge to explanatory and causal knowledge. Andalusians and Extremenos on other planets. Extremenos people are an autonomous Spanish community located in the west-central region of the Iberian Peninsula. I don't know why, but suddenly, remembering the farmers in the rice fields, I asked them another question. And that was the only time you rescued Earthlings and took them to your planets? This time it was my neighbor at the table who answered, "Now, please, we ask you to pay close attention, because what we are going to show you is something that concerns you very closely." The light slowly dimmed and on the screen appeared, filmed from very close up, a kind of building, immaculate white, well, like all the white ones I saw on the ship, with the lintels of the windows, which were just holes with nothing to close them, 2 stories high. The projection was developing rather slowly, no doubt so that I could better perceive the details. That building was made up of a kind of coupled and superimposed modules. Later I learned that it was the most appropriate form of construction on the planet Scarlet, to cope with earthquakes. In case of danger, as they told me, the modules were coupled to recovery spaceships in charge of transporting them, with their respective tenants and all their belongings, to safer places. And why allow people to live in such unsafe places? The explanation came quickly. Well, you see, this planet has excellent conditions for cosmic rest. That is why we use it as a habitable area, although we must point out that all the arrangements have been made to quickly evacuate the dangerous areas. We insist that this planet has very appropriate climatic conditions and natural resources for the cosmic rest of locals and foreigners. I must confess that, when I heard the word foreigners, without knowing why, I was on guard. I don't know the reason, I repeat, but the fact is that it gave me a very bad feeling. Because of all the tantrums that nature has on some of our planets, the woman continued, we are obtaining unsuspected resources. Hence our stubborn insistence on recommending that Earthlings make an effort to thoroughly understand the planet on which they live before setting out to decipher the mysteries of space. In the bowels of the Earth you will not only find many keys to understanding the universe, but in them Earthlings will also discover the sources of infinite life. I could not help but recall the facilities that are given on Earth to serious explorers, researchers, in order to tame and take advantage of the tantrums of our nature. For example, in the person of the first volcanologist in the world, the Frenchman Hieron Tazeef. Slowly, through the film that was being projected to me, we entered a large module attached to the building. First we crossed something that looked like a reception room. But, as if to make the situation even more mysterious, there was no one there.